Have you eaten enough? Yeah. Have you had enough information?
Never enough.
I don't know if you're aware, but there's a special arrangement between the caterer and the lecturers that for every bite of information, there's one calorie of food. That's why there's so much food. Welcome to a presentation on abuse in the workplace from a Torah perspective. I think what I want to address in less than an hour is the question: you have an employer, you have a boss, and you're mistreated, perhaps even abused. The terms of the contract are not always kept to what they're supposed to be, and often you feel you're not appreciated for the amount of work you really are investing for this corporation, La Briot. You're busting your tail, you're working very hard, you've demonstrated loyalty and integrity in the workplace, and you don't feel any real reciprocation that is parallel to what you have done in terms of appreciation from the management. Some of your efforts have been extreme to keep to the schedules and projects on time, and imagine that worse than this, you're in a bind. Why are you in a bind? Because your boss has a certain leverage on you. He signs the paycheck. But let's try and imagine, if we could find a Torah perspective of abuse in the workplace, and we looked for a very complex employment situation, where the person before you go into employment with him, you already know up front that he has a reputation for being a swindler and a cheat. And not only that, happens to be a very close relative, and more than that, happens to be the father of your wife,
and the brother,
and the father, the grandfather of your grandchildren. So you compound all that, and you have a combination of a very complex dynamic relationship where, on the one hand, you have to demonstrate honesty in the workplace, and yet you know up front you're not going to get any real appreciation, and at every turn that you have to spell out the exact terms of this employment, he's going to find loopholes and ways to show you that that's not what was really meant, and therefore he's not in violation of the original agreement. How long do you think someone would last in such a job?
Rarely 20 years.
Not 20 years. Unless they must be very weak, wimpish, not able to speak up for themselves.
Or have that written into their original contract.
Or the person has something else in mind that is way beyond the surface reading of the employer-employee relationship. So we're going to look, as you have discovered from the clues, we're going to look at the relationship of Jacob and Lavan. Yaakov and Lavan. Why? Because this is exactly what we've just described. Lavan is described as Ha'arami, which in Aramaic means, Ramai means a swindler, a cheat, a liar. Someone you can trust that you're not going to be able to trust his word. That's the only thing you can trust about him.
So stressed about his scars in the throat, and Elvin playing a piano with your left pinky backwards.
Right. Not only does he have a track record that the whole community knows about this man's dishonest dealings, his lack of integrity, but he's an idol worshipper. You're building a family under his roof. Most of the day, you're out shepherding his flocks, and many nights too, and he's home influencing your wife or wives and children. Where is your confidence going to come from that you are so secure that the wives and kids will not be tainted and will not be influenced to the negative while you're a loyal employee doing what you have to do as part of your part of the contract. How do you, in your mission to raise a Jewish family, guarantee that your kids and your wives are not going to get hurt by this person who is known to be a liar and a cheat, and of the worst type, because it's not just subtle and discreet, he's openly that way, and everyone knows it already. So there's no affront, there's no playing around the bush. He's a liar, a con man. So here we are, his father-in-law, the grandfather of his children. How is Yaakov going to deal with this? Now, to compound the question still further, is Yaakov known as a quitter, someone who runs away? No. When he left his home, having deceived, we're going to look at that word carefully, deceived his brother by taking his position of pretending to be Esav and winning the blessings from his father Isaac, who was blind at the time, his mother, Rivka, the mother of Jacob, told him, listen, I have on Ruach HaKodesh, on spiritual divine inspiration, that your brother intends to kill you for what you've just done. You took the blessings, chapter 27 in Genesis. I'm warning you now, you have to leave. And she made it look like normal, natural consequences. She spoke to her husband, you know, I think it's time for Jacob to find a wife. Why don't we send him to my brother's home? He's got two wonderful daughters, and let him choose a wife from his daughters. Isaac buys into the idea, and therefore calls Jacob in and says, you know what, we want you to go to Padan Aram, where your uncle Lavan lives, and choose a wife. It's time for you to get married. This was a cover-up to save his life. Isaac wasn't aware of the cover-up. Rivka was the designer behind it. So he wasn't someone who quit. He knew that his brother was out for his guts and was planning to harm him. His brother would never forgive him for this. And yet, Yaakov left, not because he was running away, not because he was escaping, it was because he was fulfilling the will of his parents. So his mission was to go to Padan Aram and marry. Does he fulfill that immediately without delay? No. We discover, chapter 28, he spends 14 years in yeshiva. Why? So our commentators tell us, preparation, training, how to deal with reality. Reality is not in the books. The power of information is only potential power. The real power of a person is in their choices that they make, the actions they take, the words they choose in response to what they face. The 14 years refuge, if I could call it that, in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva, contemporaries of no less than Abraham himself, was preparation for what he knew he was going to, the home of Lavan, his uncle who was a liar, a cheat, a gangster, and an idol worshipper, and not even an honest and sincere one. And he has to find a wife from one of his daughters and raise a family of children that will be totally loyal to every minute, every detail of the transmission as he received it from Isaac and his mother Rebecca, Rivka, and his grandparents Abraham and Sarah. So he spends 14 years preparing himself, and when he arrives in Padan Aram, you will find in chapter 29, the first thing that happens, maybe I should mention that he did get a prophecy in between, remember with the ladder, and he sees angels going up and down, and God promises to be with him, and promises that he will return safely to the land of Israel, because he's leaving Eretz Canaan, the land of Canaan, to go to Padan Aram, and he will safely return to his parents' home. He gets this prophecy that he will father the nation of the Jewish people. He arrives at Padan Aram, and his first encounter are a number of shepherds lazing around a well, which has a large rock covering its mouth. And Yaakov, true to his identity, our sages identify him as an Ish Emet, a true person. Now, Emet does translate as truth. It actually has an even better translation, which is more accurate. Those of you who attended the DNA of Creation, I don't know if Rabbi Silver mentioned this one, but I know that from Rabbi Shimon Schwab Hatzal, who I heard from him himself when he discussed with me different words and their roots, that the word Emet really means reality. That's why it's Aleph, Mem, and Taf, the beginning, middle, and end of the whole alphabet, because the word truth has to incorporate all reality. So when we describe Yaakov, Jacob, as an Ish Emet, a man of truth, we're saying he was real. He was a real person. What does a real person mean? A real person means, and I know we touched upon this two nights ago, I think, that in the full description given to Jacob at the tender age of 15, he had worked upon himself to reach the label, the medal on his personality, Ish Tam. Tamimut usually translates, unfortunately, mistakenly so, as innocent or simple, and it really isn't that. Tamimut, as translated in the Targum Unkelus, that's the Aramaic translation, which was part of the actual oral transmission, translates Shalem, which means complete. Complete tells us that there are parts that come together. What are the parts in a person's personality that when they come together make him or her complete? And the answer we're given is right there in Rashi, in the same chapter, chapter 25, in describing Jacob as an Ishtam. Ishtam means a complete person, says Rashi, Kaliboy Ken Piv. What was on his heart, his emotions, his mind, that's what came out his mouth. His mouth was an opening to what was inside, and it was congruent. It wasn't one thing with his mouth, and a different thing how he felt. So he was consistent. And that's why we call him Ish Emet, a real person. Because you knew, as soon as you were dealing with this personality, I'm dealing with a real person. I'm negotiating with his word is a word. His yes is yes, his no is a no, his promise is a promise. A real person, if he sees an apparent injustice, does he just turn a blind eye, or does he look to clarify before working on the assumption that maybe this is wrong? So we see the first encounter he has when he arrives in Padan Aram are these shepherds lying around by this well, and Jacob, who is a man of truth, a man of reality, says to himself, my whole life is about honesty, an honest relationship with myself first, and then an honest relationship with my Creator. And if he sees something which doesn't appear honest, he needs to clarify it before he passes judgment. And indeed, he sees them and says, you know what? You are all employees. Usually shepherds are not the owners. Why are you lousing around the well? It's still daytime. It's not yet sunset. Why aren't you still grazing the flocks? And he wasn't saying this as a reprimand or an accusation. He was simply asking for clarity. And they responded, well, there's a rock on the well here, and we come here early so that eventually everyone will congregate, all the shepherds will come together, and between us all we'll be able to lift up the rock and draw out water for the flocks, and then we put the rock back. But we all have to come here, so we will come here at different times. That was a satisfactory answer. What? No, because water was a major commodity. Poland Springs beer was a beer much more expensive than nowadays. In fact, you know, if you owned wells, you were wealthy. Anyway, I never thought of that. Yeah. So that was the reality of the lifestyle and culture in those times. Meanwhile, he says to the shepherds, no, please tell me, do you know of Lavan? Sure, we know about him. So tell me, is he in good shape? Is he fine? Yeah, he's B'Shalom, he's in peace, don't worry about him. In fact, just over here is Rachel, his daughter. She's a shepherdess. They came from a poor family. Lavan was not a wealthy man. So much so that he only had daughters at that time, and they were the shepherds, or shepherdesses of his flocks. And they didn't have many. How do we know? Because the deduction is, since Rachel was so young, and she was single-handedly shepherding the flocks, it was unlikely that she had hundreds and hundreds. On his first encounter with Rachel, he experiences a spiritual divine inspiration that this is his true soulmate. And the Torah goes out of its way to describe he had an affinity towards her. He had a feeling of love towards this woman. He arrives in Padan Aram. She goes ahead of him and tells her father, you know, your nephew, Jacob, has arrived. Whoa, says Lavan. Good news! Why is that good news? Because Lavan's mindset, as we will recall, when he first encountered Eliezer in chapter 24. Eliezer was the servant of Abraham, and Abraham sent Eliezer to find a shidduch for Isaac, his son. So Eliezer arrived in Padan Aram to get a daughter from Betuel, and Lavan was the sister of Rivka, and he was very impressed by the wealth and riches. He actually even thought Eliezer was Abraham himself and wanted to assassinate him and just keep all the riches. Hey, wait a minute. If Eliezer came so loaded with camels and donkeys, so much jewelry, diamonds, rubies, imagine Jacob, the grandson, how much he's going to be coming with. And imagine the disappointment as he runs out and sees that Jacob comes empty-handed. So he assumes, you know, it must be in his jacket. So he gives him a big hug. Nothing there. So he decides to give a big thumping kiss on the cheeks. There must be hidden jewelry inside his mouth. Nothing doing. So he asks, well, what are you doing here? So my parents sent me here to find a wife. So look, you're my nephew, so you know, I'll give you hospitality. You can stay for a month. And in that month he made him work. And he did such a good job of being shepherd that he said, you know what? Instead of me throwing him out of the house, I'm going to offer him employment. Tell me what would be your wages. And Yaakov was very explicit. He knew exactly what he wanted up front. And he spells it out. He says, I want your daughter, Rachel, Bitra, your daughter, Haktana, the young one. It's very clear. Now he's only got two daughters, Rachel and Leah at this point. Zilpah and Bilhah are not mentioned, the other two daughters. They were actually from a different wife. The same father, different wife. And he's putting into the contract, Rachel, no other Rachel, your daughter, and if you're going to change Leah's name to Rachel, I'm talking about your youngest daughter. So there's no mistake who we are discussing. I'll work for your daughter. They write up a 7-year contract, and the Torah describes, strangely, that these 7 years went by like a few days. How can that be? What does it mean when you're looking forward to some special date, your wedding? Does the time go very fast or very slow? It goes very slow. I can't wait. Counting the days, this is ridiculous. So what does it mean over here? The 7 years were like a few days? So the sages tell us the following. I'm going to embellish it somewhat. Someone who is training in the Olympics is working 7 hours workout a day. 7 days a year. 365 days a year for 4 years. Right? Does the time go slowly or fast? You ask these athletes, time goes very fast. Because they're intensely focused on the target. And even though the hours, days, weeks and months, it goes very quickly. Their mind is only on one thing. How good can they get to be before the final race? And if they would have one more day, guess what they would be doing in that one more day? They'd be preparing another day and another day. Jacob understood the one message which his parents and grandparents gave him. That this world, we spoke slightly about it yesterday, day before, I'm totally out of time. We spoke about, this world is called Olam HaNisayon, a world of test. It's really a theater. You know what's really amazing? Any of you have ever been to Hollywood and actually seen a scene of a movie? Now, I never saw Hollywood in that context, but I remember in England, the equivalent of Hollywood is Pinewood Studios. It's actually closed down, unfortunately, because the film industry went very dry there the last few years. But in its heyday, I remember my father taking me there many times, And two particular movies I remember, You Only Live Twice, that was one of the Bond movies. They had the volcano, so that was a big set. Inside of the volcano was actually a gigantic, almost size of a very, very large building, maybe 20, 30 stories high. And what's interesting is when you see Sean Connery in front of the camera, there's not one camera, there are several cameras, taken from different angles, filming simultaneously, and you've got several actors either in conversation or moving around the stage. But when you see the final film, the reality of the technicians, the cameramen, the cameras, the producer, the director, and all the rest of the technical crew don't exist. And while they're on stage, what is the focus of the actor and the actress? Their eyes never clash with the camera. Never once. Unless it's part of the actual script. It's unusual. But in a regular movie, you will never see the actor look right into the camera. Because this is not real. Right. Olam HaNisayon.
They filmed a scene once in front of my grandfather's house. Spent the whole day filming the scene.
Right.
My sister and I said, oh, we've got to go see this movie. Right. The entire scene that they were spending, the entire day filming, approximately 5 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. It's not unusual for thousands of hours to go into a few seconds until they edit out which takes they want, etc. And this is how it works. This is how it works. This world is a test. And the joke is, do we know the camera is on, that there's a whole crew around us? Or do I think that the reality is this actor and actress is bouncing off me? The props and the words, and that all this is real. Jacob was imbibed by his parents and grandparents that everything in this world is a theater. That everything that happens is really how to provide the circumstances to bring out what's inside of us. What we bring out from ourselves is the opportunity for personal growth. Everything else are just props. And the three biggest props are earning a living, marriage, and raising kids. Now, between you and me, if I was there at creation when God created man, I would have done away with the stomach. It's a waste. You know, do you realize if we didn't have stomachs, do you understand the ramifications of the... Such a big change in lifestyle. You don't have to go to work for a paycheck. Because food doesn't have to grow. You don't eat food. You just have God, you know, in your ultimate wisdom, just design a more sophisticated respiratory system. Put all the nutrients and amino acids and proteins and everything we need in the atmosphere. You're perfectly capable. Just made a gas out of it all. And we'll breathe it in. And live totally healthy and energized on air. So why did God create a stomach? Because he wants us to go to work and face difficult clients, difficult co-workers, difficult boss, and then talk about it with your spouse when you get home and hear their feedback. It's your fault! You have to stand up for yourself! How can you let him talk to you like that? And wasn't the contract... Yeah, but... God wants me to be put in a position of handling difficulty, but all those difficulties are really just cameras and props and other actors and actresses. They're not interested in what's going on around me. God's interested in what's going to come out from me because of what's around me. So he invents a stomach. He also invented giving birth to children. Now, if children were to grow off trees... Are there any ladies in this audience who would raise their hands to say, that's a good idea? And they would come with volume controls. Why do you have to have... Why do you have to have a remote control? Turn them off when you... Why do you have to have children start as a seed? A lady has to become pregnant and go through the pain of pregnancy, childbirth and labor, and finally raising these wonderful infants. Ah, sweet child. the greatest pleasure and the greatest pain simultaneously are kids. God, you know what? Just to have them grow off the trees and life would be a whole lot easier. So I won't be so emotionally attached. But at least I could be independent. And why marriage? Companionship, you know, you only have to have this contract that says until inconvenience, I mean, till death us do part. What? Why do we have to be so committed? Do away with that too. And God says, no, you know what? I created a world where I know you would not change if you weren't forced to. You would not grow unless forced to. Unless I squeeze what's inside, I'm not going to know what's inside. So the purpose of marriage, the purpose of raising kids, and the purpose of earning a living is for those three stages to be the place where I act out who I am inside. And Jacob understood this. So that when he asked for his wages, it wasn't money. He wanted to marry a righteous individual. He wanted to marry Rachel. And therefore, in those first 7 years where he bust his tail day and night, our sages tell us if it was frost, snow, Jacob was there watching the sheep, counting the morning, counting them in the evening. If ever there was one of the sheep missing, he would take out of his wages and replace it. That's the level of responsibility he held himself to. That wasn't necessarily part of the contract, and it wasn't even perhaps halakhically, in Jewish law, legally a requirement. But we're discussing someone whose whole life mission was, if I'm tempted to cheat on my boss, not only will it not be a temptation for me, I want to use that as an opportunity to say, absolutely not. No, I'm going to be loyal no matter what. Whether it's the timing, whether it's the use of the items on at work. And this is why he wanted to pay for everything out of his own pocket if there was ever a loss to his owner. But wait a minute, aren't you going to deplete your assets? Well, Jacob had a different mindset. His statement was, you know what, God has already made this just one big movie. I'm here, and I make up the script as I go along. God has already promised me that he's going to provide for me. So it's not dependent on how hard I work, and it's not dependent on how much I pay out for mistakes I make. And I'm not drawing parallels right now that we have to then, you know, pay for the days that we take off or whatever. I'm not drawing that parallel at this moment. I'm just helping us understand how was Jacob able to get beyond the fact that he had a father-in-law and a boss who was the grandfather of his children who was abusive and a liar and a cheat. How did he deal with that? So for those 7 years, Jacob is the a loyal shepherd. And then, end of 7 years. And these years went by like days. Why? Because 14 years went by very quickly in yeshiva, studying Torah to give himself clarity. That's what Torah really means. It means clarity. To get clarity on being able to identify this lover and there's a lion, a gangster, I better know how to stand up to him. In fact, when he first met Rachel, and she warned him, my father's a gangster and a liar, he's not going to easily marry you to me. You know what he said? I am your father's brother. What do you mean, Achi Lavan, your father's brother? Say our sages, he wasn't related as a brother. No, he meant, I can be his brother in deceit. But don't we know that deceit is something that eats away at one's character of integrity, at one's character trait of honesty and truth? Listen carefully. When Jacob was told by his mother, my dear son, your father wants to bless your evil brother, I want you to substitute your brother, was Jacob's first response, oh, that's a great idea, Mum. What shall I do next? No! He said, Mom, I can't do that. I'm going to deceive Dad. What if he finds out? He won't bless me, he'll curse me. And his mother said, my dear son, I have on Ruach HaKodesh, I have divine inspiration, this is the correct thing to do. You don't have to worry. Jacob was still concerned. And what was he concerned for? He took it on authority of his mother because he knew his mother was a greater prophetess than his own. But he was still concerned on a personal level that by telling a lie, when his father says, "Who are you? You don't sound like my son Esav." He didn't want to give a response that was totally deceitful. He wanted to remind himself that right now he's only acting. He's not being real. But if I know I'm acting, I can be real in knowing that I'm only acting. And so when he responded to his father in chapter 27, and Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" It's an interesting voice. You've got the voice of Esav. And yet let me feel you. Oh, your skin is... Sorry, you've got the voice of Jacob, and your skin is the skin of Esav. He was wearing the hunting jacket of Esav. That's correct. That's correct. Well, he can't. It's very difficult to hide tonality. You have to be a real expert in imitating someone else's voice. But that is possible, especially they're twins. It's possible. But you're quite right. In the tonality, in the way he spoke to his father, he was much more respectful and refined in his tone of voice than Esav.
Like,
sorry.
Said, "How is this? You're back so fast," and he said, "Hashem."
Yes, that's correct. That's right. That's right. He said, God gave me speed in getting the food for you. So Esav was not known for mentioning God's name in such an appreciative context. So now, what was the response of Jacob when he said to his father, when his father asked him, "Who are you?" He said, "Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv." Jacob said to his father, chapter 27, verse 19, "Anochi, I am." And under his breath, he said, "Jacob." And the next two words was, "Esav b'chayrcha." Esav is your firstborn. Why did he do that? Because he wanted to tell himself, "I'm being real about acting." My father told me something very powerful. I think I may have shared this, with this audience, that there's no profession in history where people get so much accolades, recognition, admiration, validation for who they are or not, as actors and actresses. And it goes so deep that the actors and actresses themselves, when they're off stage, the well-known ones, how do you think most of us relate to them when we meet them? "Oh my gosh, Liz Taylor, wow, I've watched all your movies, you are so special, I love you," right? What do you think that does to them? Does it help them be clear about their identity as, when I'm on screen, I'm an actor, when I'm home, I'm a parent, no, total confusion. In fact, if they're playing a love role in a movie, is it possible that there might be a little bit of confusion? Absolutely. That's why the average number of marriages of an actor and actress in England and America is 4 times. Isn't that amazing? I remember when I was in school, I was throwing out the interesting information here, Roger Moore, he was married 3 times, Sean Connery, 3 times, Albert Finney, his daughter was in my class, he was married 3 times, she was from the first marriage, Stanley Kubrick, His daughter was married he was married 3 times. Peter Sellers, you remember Peter Sellers? He was married 3 times. I don't know what number 3 is. It's unbelievable. Again and again and again. Why? Because the identity is not clear to themselves. In fact, Larry Hagman did such a good job of JR. Who killed JR? He was such a gangster, a liar, a cheat, and everything else, that in real life, he receives hate letters in the mail. Yeah. People spit at him in the streets. "Wait a minute, don't you know he's only acting?" Jacob, this one time he was going to deceive his father to protect the destiny of the Jewish people, still on a personal basis was so sensitive that he wanted to remind himself, "I'm going to be real about the fact that I'm not being real right now." And that's honesty. So when it came to dealing with his uncle, he tells his wife-to-be, Rachel, "Don't worry, I will be a brother to your father. I will match him in being a swindler, a cheat." And her answer to him was, is a righteous person allowed to deceive? And his response to that was, if you're dealing with someone who's a liar and cheat, you can't be a tamim. You can't be real with them on their level, because you're going to get hurt. You have to be shrewd in order to protect yourself, and that's permitted. So Jacob enters this relationship with a certain amount of self-knowledge, clarity about what he wants, what he's working for. It's not the wage. And therefore, the fact that the wage was changed only 100 times, it, of course, was a matter of deceit. But for him, he wasn't working for that anyway. He understood that the real test was, I'm spending these 7 years in learning how to be a loyal employee. And I'm spending these 7 years watching Lavan, how he relates to his wife and children. And I'm preparing myself for when I marry his daughter, / daughters, I will know what I'm dealing with. No surprises. I will know how to raise my kids. I will learn now how to communicate to Rachel, so that in advance, I am preparing myself for husbandship, so to speak, for marriage. And therefore, these 7 years was 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for 7 years training for a gold medal in the Olympics of marriage. And that's why the days went by so quick. Every time he listened to his father-in-law and had a conversation with Rachel about it, he was straight shooter, clear, real, honest, emotionally congruent with what he said and thought and felt. And he built up intimacy that way with his wife-to-be. And when it came to Lavan, he tried his best to make the terms clear, but Lavan always out-cheated him. But it didn't matter, as long as he got what he wanted in the end. Came 7 years, and he was fooled into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. And he gets up the next morning, says, Lavan, I think we should have a conversation. This is not the woman I worked 7 years for. And Lavan says, oh yeah, I completely forgot to tell you that we have a custom in this community that we don't marry off the younger daughter before the older one. So we gave you Leah instead. But you know what? Work another 7 years and you can have Rachel at the end of 1 week. So 1 week later, after the festivities of the wedding were over with Leah, and that's where the first source of Sheva Brachas comes from, a week later, he married Rachel, but by contract, he had to work another 7 years. Now, you and I could easily say, how could the guy take that? Why didn't he just marry her after a week and then run away? Why should he keep his word? The guy is a liar and a cheat. He's abusive. He squeezes everything out of this man. He shows no appreciation for every time he sleeps at night watching the flock. Any sheep missing or killed by a wolf or a wild animal, Jacob replaces from his own pocket. And Lavan has no appreciation of that. Get out of there. And Jacob says, no, that's not what it's about. I got so strong from this, I'm ready for another 7 years. And I'm going to get stronger. Because if I can raise a family in Lavan's home, if I can raise a family of children who can be exposed to an idol worshipper under the same roof and understand from mommy and daddy what real values are and see how mommy and daddy treat each other, see the loyalty between us, compare it to the promiscuity and lucid idol worship lifestyle of Lavan and his cohorts, and they choose to remain loyal to my transmission, I couldn't have chosen a better place to raise my kids. Now that doesn't mean we should go out and put our kids in the worst public school in the country. No. That's not what we're talking about. But we're understanding Jacob came from a totally different perspective. He understood that money wasn't the purpose, because that's going to come either way. God has already destined how much I'm going to earn. How I behave at work is going to determine who I become in my integrity, in my honesty, in the strength that I have to stand up for myself and clarify the terms. How I speak to my wife, and listen to this dimension. Your children see their father being abused by their grandfather. Your children see your father silent when he is insulted or doesn't get any appreciation. They're either going to say, Dad's a wimp and a weakling, how can we respect him? Or if he's coming from strength, and the reason why he's silent is because he's strong inside, I don't need to argue with this man. And he doesn't, they don't hear him complaining, oh, I cannot believe what your father did to me today. I just can't take it anymore. How many years am I going to continue this? If they heard him whining and complaining about their granddad, what would it have done to their Jewish education? Oh, no. This man, Jacob, an Ish Emes, a man of truth, did not slander his father-in-law. He was respectful to him. At the end of the second seven-year period, he says to his father-in-law, it's time for me to move on. I would like to get your permission to go back to my hometown. Oh, listen, it's been great knowing you, but I know from my own divination through black magic that my success, my exponential wealth in these last 14 years is because of you. I'm not letting you go so quick. Stick around for a few more years. Just tell me, what's the price? I'll pay it. This is what Laban's saying back to Jacob. And Jacob says, you know what? I tell you what, I don't want any money from you. I tell you what, I'll make a deal. You will give me all the sheep that are born from your striped males and females that mate. Well, that's a great deal. That's a great deal. He's not asking me for anything. All he's asking me for is silly striped sheep that are born from this match over here. So it's not going to cost me anything, and he's willing to stay another 6 years. What Laban didn't know was that Jacob became exceptionally wealthy from this. Very rarely, if ever, do you see the Torah use the language Vayifreitz ha'ish ma'id ma'id. This man became burstingly, extremely wealthy. Yifreitz is bursting, exceedingly wealthy from all the procreation of these animals. So by the end of 6 years, he had a whole chain store of shepherds looking after his flocks. But the children saw Dad totally loyal, honest, kept his word, stayed up nights, never lied, never cheated back. They saw their grandfather trick, lie, cheat. And they saw Dad was always respectful to his grandfather, to his father-in-law, to their grandfather. What does that do to the education of the kid? Imagine you get married to a wonderful spouse, and her parents are not religious. They're not just not religious, and they're anti-religious. Totally insensitive of anything you believe in. And you invite them to your home, and your children are growing up. How do you talk to your kids about your parents, their grandparents? How do you explain that they don't follow or agree or are disrespectful or even insulting about your lifestyle, and they're your children's grandparents? Whoa. When we answer back to our boss or our clients or our co-workers what they deserve, does it usually improve the situation or just makes it worse? I'll give you a ridiculous scenario. You have a boss who badmouths people, and he's insulting, he's got a short temper, and you have been on the receiving end of that temper many a time. Worse still, you're the only Jew in this company, and he singles you out for certain anti-Semitic subtle comments, and he signs your paycheck, and it's very difficult for you to know how to respond to this man. And it's even more difficult for your co-workers, who even if they wanted to protect you, they're also employees. So there you feel like they've got to kind of side with him when he's around, and like kind of apologize or feel uncomfortable when he's not and they're in your presence. What would happen if in place of me coming to work resentful, angry, and underneath very bitter and wishing I could get back at this man, that I would find things or virtues about him and say, you know what, one thing I really like about the boss is, and you talk about whether it's hardworking or it's punctuality or whether he pays on time, whatever it is that you can think of, and let that filter through the other employees, that they don't hear someone speaking badly about the boss who themselves are on the receiving end of insult and perhaps even abuse. What will happen in terms of their respect for you? What will happen if the boss finds out that these compliments are being filtered down? Or that in place of being shouted at, a person says to the boss, you know what, I'm trying carefully to listen to what you're saying. The fact that you're angry forces me to conclude you must have had a really hard day. I'm only suggesting over here. Now what would happen in place of becoming attached to the insult or the intensity of the anger, which we ordinarily translate as abuse, and it is, and it's painful, and it is, what would happen if we turn it around and look for what's good in that person, not because they deserve it, and we're respectful of that person, not because they deserve it, but because this is about me growing. And when you get harsh and difficult, that's what makes the opportunity even bigger. Because when you squeeze me tighter, more of what's inside of me is going to come out. Whether it's resentment and bitterness that's been building up, or whether it's looking for some form of compassion to the people that I'm surrounded by, that never, poor people, that they're in this rut, in this vicious cycle, that because of the paycheck, they're stuck in having to side with an abusive boss. Maybe I can break that cycle. Jacob's whole raison d'etre, his whole purpose in marriage, raising the kids, and earning a living with this abusive person, was not about how happy I can make this family, how good the conditions can it be in the workplace. No, he created his own happiness and his own conditions by setting the standard. No matter how I'm treated, I will be loyal. No matter how I'm spoken to, I remain true to my word. I will put in my full hours and even beyond. Yes, if I'm busting my tail and I need more time for the family and it's beyond the description of the terms of our contract, I will say, you know what? I'm concerned that I'm not being able to serve you the way I need to because I'm getting burnt out. I need to take time off when I'm putting in the extra hours for the project so that I can be there full tank, fueled to give my best when I'm getting ahead in this project. I'm putting it in his terms. I'm saying it's for your benefit. Of course I'm going to spend that extra time at home, relaxing, maybe take an extra vacation, whatever it is. But essentially, if my loyalty is, I want the company to prosper while I'm here, and I make that clear that my priority is my employment means I'm here to serve you. That's what my paycheck equals. And that's what honesty and loyalty essentially adds up to. You have a question?
Yeah. How do you balance the situations, and do you believe there's situations where you do have to be firm and strong, and because, you know, people might see that kind of weak. You know, there's certain situations where, you know, if you don't put your position, if you don't...
Right. So bring this more... Yeah.
With the fact that sometimes you just have to quiet it.
Right. So to expand your question, if I can put your question out more clearly, you made it clear, but I'm make it a wider application. A person has self-esteem. A person has their personal agenda. And where I've got a boss who's not treating me right, is not giving me much appreciation, it's hurting the motivation that I want to have for this work. And I've got to protect myself, because if I'm going to come home feeling less than or low or cheated or unappreciated or taken advantage of, I'm going to lose my self-respect. My spouse is going to lose respect for me not standing up for myself. and it's going to filter down to my kids, and everyone's going to suffer, and they're going to blame me because I'm working so hard, I'm not earning enough, and I'm not getting treated or appreciated, financially compensated, or with accolades.
Subordinates as well.
Sorry?
If you have subordinates as well,
yeah.
You feel that.
Right. And I feel the answer to that is the following. Taking an example from Yaakov can be the example par excellence. But in real life, the boss owes me whatever's on contract. And if there's a violation of that contract, even though he is supposed to be aware of it, if he's playing or claims genuinely is not aware that that was part of the contract, it's absolutely my obligation to bring it to his attention. How I bring it to his attention will very much determine the receptivity of the response. So, if I need to say, look, in the original contract, what we agreed to was that when I work late for certain projects, so I come in late the next morning, and I've noticed that because of the pressures, if I came in late the next morning, other things are not going to get done, and then the job's not going to be done as according to the contract. But I'm in a situation where I'm starting to get burnt out, and I'm not able to support you at the level I really need to support you and be there for the job, because I'm simply emotionally and physically wiped out. So what I need is either a different financial compensation for the extra hours that I'm putting in, and I'm not getting what was in the contract in terms of coming in late, or, and I'm more than ready to do this, keep to the original contract that I'm going to come in late the next morning, and delegation has to be implemented so that the things that I would have done had I come in on time, someone else has to take. And it can't be on my shoulders because I'm shouldering more responsibility with these extra projects than was originally agreed to. So, if the boss is unreasonable, and there are many of them, if he's feels that now you're taking advantage of him, help him to understand that this is not about me trying to squeeze the most out of my terms and giving you the least. I'm talking about giving you my maximum and what I need to be able to serve you and build this department, the company, the bottom line, the revenue, the sales, the marketing, the managing, whatever department I'm in, and specify clearly this is what I know I can do more of if I can have this time off. And you give me options, whatever it is. Yaakov's mindset was, let Lavan do what he wants. I'm getting what I want. Because I'm practicing loyalty, and I'm practicing taking insult with silence, but not from weakness, from strength. And when my kids see that, wow, do they have respect for dad. When the wife sees that, wow, do they have respect for their husband. That he's capable of standing up, and if he chooses to do so, he will. And if he chooses not to, he also... So who's the boss? The one who's in control of themselves. And this is the point that was really made. Now I'll just bring out, and I'm going to close in a few moments, and I'll be happy to take any questions. When Jacob gave birth, through Rachel, to Joseph, God appears to Jacob and says, it's time for you to return to your home. And what does he do? He goes to his wives, and he says, you know what, let's talk out in the field, I don't want anyone listening. God spoke to me last night and said that it's time for me to go back to my homeland. What do you think? Now, you're talking to two of the four matriarchs. These are two columns of the entire Jewish nation. What do you think their answer is going to be? Two good, loyal Jewish mummies, beautifully...
Let's go!
God spoke to you, there's nothing to talk about! Right? And yet, what do we see? I'm just going to find it for you. Chapter 31. Let's go from verse 3. Vayom Hashem el Yaakov, God said to Jacob, Shuv el eretz avosecha, go back to the land of your parents, ulamoladatecha, from the place where you were born, ve'eh yaimach, I'll be with you. That's a great guarantee. Next words. Vayishlach Yaakov, Yaakov sent a message, v'yikra l'rachel ul'leah, and he called Rachel and Leah, hasadeh, to the field, el Sinai, where he was taking care of the flocks, which is very telling, he didn't want to ever be away from the flocks, kept his loyalty up to the last moment. Vayoyma lahen, he said to them, Roy anochi et pnei avichen, I see your father's face, ki enenu elai kitmosh shon, he's not treating me like before, it's got even worse, ve'elokei avi hayimadi. My parents' God came to me, skipping all the lines here, told me to go back. So what did they say to him? What did they say to him? V'ta'an Rachel v'Leah, that chapter 31 verse 14. Rachel and Leah responded, v'ta'man Allah, and they said to him, Ha'oid lanu chelik v'nachala, do we have any portion or inheritance beves avinu in our father's house? What have we got to stay for? Haloi nachriyos nechshavnu loy. He treats us as strangers. Our father, that special relationship between a father and a daughter, he treats us like strangers. He's used us all our lives. We were his shepherdesses before you came on the scene. And all the time that we've been married to you, he used us to gain employment from you. And he took advantage of your loyalty for his own means. So we've got nothing to lose out by going. What? What? Well, they're not. I don't think they're giving an evaluation. They're giving an observation. There's a big difference. They're stating the facts.
But they said it together, though.
Yep.
Singular.
Yes. Ki machranu, he sold us. Vayoichel gam achol et kaspenu, and all the money that he gave us as part of the dowry, he ate it up. So what are we attached to, emotionally or physically, that we should stay? Ki chol ha'oisha, all the wealth, asher hitzil Elokim me'avinu lanuhu uvanenu, all the wealth that exists here is really because God has given it to us. It's not his. The Ata, and now, P.S. at the end of the answer, the Ata, and now, Kol Asher Amar Elokim Elecha, everything God said to you, Asay, do. Wait a minute, these are the matriarchs. They give this whole spiel, a whole explanation of rationally, you know what? Come to think of it, you know, Dad doesn't really teach us that well anyway. He's eaten up our dowries, he's always taken advantage of us. We got the feeling he really sold us to you, never even really married us off. He just took advantage of it. We have no relationship with the man. So, whatever God says, you should do. Well, these are the matriarchs. See, a good, frum, fanatical wife would say, God spoke to you, there's nothing to talk about. No, because they were raised by Jacob to understand that whenever you want to do God's will, be real. Be aware what is at stake here. I want to do God's will, but there's a reality. I want to keep Shabbos, I want to keep Kashrus, but there's still a reality in my secular lifestyle that I've got to deal with. The boss that I'm dealing with, and the co-workers I'm dealing with, should I wear yarmulke, not wear yarmulke, daven mincha, not daven mincha, there's a reality. Jacob trained them that when God has a will, I still have to be real about my reality and not just say, right, that's it, fine, everything shut to side, I'm praying now, I'm learning out. Wait a minute, there's a reality, there's family life, there's raising kids. Maybe I have to put aside some of my religious observance, and I don't mean, God forbid, I'm not going to learn, I'm not going to pray, but maybe I've got to make more of a priority out of other parts in my life so that it will blend and become God's will. But I've got to be real about who I am. So the first thing they said was, let's be real. Let's look at the situation. Let's observe the reality. If we just say, yeah, God says so, we have to leave our father's house. If there's a feeling of attachment to the homeland, a feeling of attachment to their father, their family, that they're going to miss, that is going to somehow, subconsciously or even consciously, sabotage their performance in doing God's will. So let's be real first. And the reality is, there is nothing holding us back from what God told you to do. And I'll give you another example of this. Incredible. It's really only parenthetic here, but it brings it out very powerfully. How do we know this is accurate? When Joseph had an attempted seduction from this beautiful woman, Salusha, the wife of Potiphar, begging him every day, sleep with me. And she designed all sorts of scenarios where no one would know. It would be secluded. And finally, on one day,